Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is a real dilemma for anybody operating in this space, whether you're a journalist covering it or whether you're a committee considering how much do we need to be wary that we are giving them a platform which allows them to recruit. But also, how much do we need to be wary of engaging in censorship, is too strong a word, but silencing or ignoring of these voices in a way that confirms their conspiracy theories and justifies in their minds what they believe?
Hello, good people of podcasts, and welcome to another episode of the show. You are with Catherine Murphy, the host and political editor of Guardian Australia. And this week, I'm joined in the pod cave by James Patterson, who is a Liberal senator, and he is the chair of Parliament's, say it for me, James, so I don't get the name wrong.
Powerful, yes. Intelligence and Security Committee.
That's kind of a spoiler about what might be coming up. Anyway, yes, James recently stepped into the chair of this committee, which the former chair was Andrew Hastie, who's moved up into the ministry. And I'm also with my wingman. That's where you introduce yourself, Daniel.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't recognise the title. Daniel Hurst here.
Yes, Daniel Hurst. Regular listeners will know Daniel is in the Bureau in Canberra and he focuses on foreign defence security matters, which is why he's in with James and myself for this conversation. So let's start with the security environment at the moment. The committee is, well, the committee has a broad gamut of looking right across the security environment. There's a particular focus on extremism at the moment. So let's talk about that. How do you see the general security environment in Australia at the moment?
That's a really good and broad opening question, Catherine. The advice from our security agencies is that we have for some time been operating in a very serious threat environment. They classify it in their list of priorities as a probable threat environment, and that hasn't changed. And in most recent years, that threat has predominantly been from Islamist extremism, Islamist terrorism. But both ASIO, Victoria Police, other agencies that have submitted as part of this inquiry note that there is a growing threat of far-right extremist violence. They're concerned about that as a growing issue, and it is taking up a greater proportion of their workload. ASIO points out that they've been tracking right-wing extremists for decades. This is not a new issue, but it is an emerging issue, and it's taking up even more of their time. And obviously the Christchurch shooting in New Zealand, which was an Australian citizen who conducted it and was a right-wing extremist, is a demonstration of how much damage just one person can do, acting on their own if they have access to a firearm. And other experiences in Australia on the Islamist terrorist front show that, again, unsophisticated, technically, attacks simply with a knife or a car can have enormous effect on soft targets, people walking around the street, and have a profound impact on our sense of safety and security in Australia.
And you said, James, that obviously right-wing extremism isn't a new phenomenon in Australia. It's just become, it's come to the fore in recent times and is taking up more of a share of the workload for intelligence agencies. Why do we think that is?
There's lots of different factors that are contributing to it, but like other forms of extremists, right-wing extremists, particularly neo-Nazis and white supremacists or white nationalists, are radicalised online. They have access to increasingly extreme content that is influencing them, and disturbingly, increasingly young people are being influenced by this material. ASIO says that it's monitoring in both the Islamist space and the right-wing extremist space people as young as 13 and 14 who are consuming this material and exhibiting tendencies tendencies towards use of violence to justify their political objectives. Now, it's obviously only of interest to any security agency or force if the political beliefs they hold cross into the territory of justifying violence to achieve those ends. In Australia, you're entitled to have whatever weird and wacky beliefs you have if you only hold them peacefully and all you do is go to coffee shops and family barbecues and try and convince others of your wacky views. But if you show tendencies towards violence, then that's when you become of interest.
And what about over the Christmas break in the US? I mean, it takes us away from our own environment, but the storming of the Capitol was quite, well, I can't find words for that, really.
You're not alone. I'm actually a former congressional intern, and when I was at university, led tours of that Capitol building for constituents of my congressman and gave them very poor, very potted history of their own country. I remember pointing out the apotheosis of Washington, which is the mural on the top of the Capitol dome, and explaining what that meant to them. It was very disturbing for me watching it, having had that memory of seeing rioters run amok around the Capitol in areas that, you know, we weren't even allowed to go as permitted guests in the building. It was very disturbing, and to show how vulnerable a public space like that can be to a large crowd sufficiently riled up as they were. And that is a real lesson for us about our institutions and why they need to be protected and upheld, and why all of us in political life particularly have an obligation to support and not undermine those institutions, because very serious consequences can flow.
It's interesting you say riled up. Who did the riling up?
It's unquestionable that President Trump played a very important role in that. He wasn't the only actor in that space. They have a very vibrant and diverse media environment that contributed to that. But when he tried to convince and largely successfully convince his supporters that the election had been stolen from them and that they had to do something about it, I don't think what followed was terribly surprising.
I mean, well, without going too much of a diversion, but it seems like some people on the right of politics aren't able to say openly what you said about Trump. Do you think, like, what sort of reckoning should the events of 6th of January cause on the conservative side of politics and the way that debate is conducted and the way that messages can be sent to people, including people who hear more extreme messages and take action from
them? Yeah. Well, I try and take a step back as a parliamentarian and just look at this issue as someone who's interested in politics, who's lived in the United States and follows it with great interest. I mean, the Republican Party is going to have a fascinating internal debate over the next few years of, are they a Trump party? Are they a post-Trump party? To what extent do they move away from him as an individual, as a figure? To what extent do they retain some of his philosophy? My observation of Trump and his impact on the Republican Party is that he's obviously been a driving force for the change in the Republican Party, but he was tapping into a sentiment that was already latent and there. And the ideology or the philosophy of Trumpism is here to stay in some form. It may have a different face, it may have different adherents and promoters, but I think the underlying causes that he tapped into are not going away.
And just on that, but I want to come to exactly that point, because it sort of brings us home in a way and makes us think about what the causes, what the drivers are of similar currents here. But just in terms of the Capitol, and you said we've all got to think about that institutionally, has the committee expressed any interests or concerns? I mean, obviously, I was here in 1996. So I can't remember when that demo was. Yeah. And that's obviously, it's a different set of circumstances, but still the building was breached, right? And we think we work in the most secure building in the country, and I'm sure we do. But I'm sure they thought the same in the Capitol, which is a very locked down space. Has the Intelligence Committee thought, in the wake of the Capitol, maybe we should look at what's going on in the building?
Yeah, but my experience of working in the US Congress briefly and working in this building is that our building actually has always been more secure than theirs. Ours was purpose-built in a more modern era than theirs is. Theirs is a historical building, and it's had so many attachments and accoutrements added onto it that it's actually historically hasn't been that secure. They built a massive new visitors centre and visitors wing to try and overcome that, because visitors of the building were just walking into the congressional offices for a meeting with their congressman, and they have a strong philosophical view that constituents should be able to access their representatives. And I share that. And you would know in this building in recent years, we've massively increased the security apparatus and presence here, both in terms of personnel, but in terms of the physical hardening of the building. And that's been based on very good advice. And I think on balance, it's the right thing to do. But I do share that underlying philosophy that it's unfortunate that it has made us kind of a bit more, even more remote than we already are, being here away from our constituents, from the people we're here to represent. And we have become a less accessible building. And the image that we project project into the immediate surrounds is one of an inaccessible building with all the extra obstacles we've placed in the way of getting in here. Mm. Now, again, I say that they're for good and necessary reasons. They're based on good intelligence, and we can't afford to not heed that. But I do think a little something has been lost in that process.
Yeah, sure. Just back to the driving causes of Trumpism, right? Like, I mean, that's sort of reasonable shorthand. The sort of precursor elements of Trumpism are a reasonable shorthand for why we're seeing an uptick in right-wing extremism. So, because, you know, we could see an uptick in left-wing extremism, right? Because there's sort of populism of both forms, right, mm-hmm. in evidence in the political landscape internationally at the moment, mm. right? So why is it that these sort of white supremacist groups, often with violent sort of tendencies, what is it about the current environment that is enlivening that?
I think it's certainly clear that some of these groups do identify with Trump and have adopted Trump as their representative, but we should be very careful to point out that they pre-existed him and predated him in politics, both in the United States, but particularly in Europe. There's a very long history of quite radical extremism on the right in Europe. And, you know, neo-Nazism, for example, in France and Germany has never gone away. It is an ongoing and prevalent threat, and as is Islamist extremism in those countries that targets the Jewish community in particular, when we see beheadings at synagogues in France and other sort of attacks. So this is a phenomenon that's been with us for a long time, but it does appear to be increasing. It's really hard to associate that with any one political development. A lot of the advice that we've got in this early stages is it's associated with scepticism about globalization. Mm. You see lots of elements of scepticism about international trade, about breaking down the barriers of migration, and scepticism about multilateral institutions and what their real objectives are versus their stated objectives. There's a lot of fear in some sections of the community about that.
And because, like we're seeing in Victoria, you know, we've seen these sort of instances of open anti-Semitism, schools and so on. Josh Frydenberg's raised it.
Yep.
There was that incident.
The gatherings and the Grampians.
Yeah, the Grampians, right. I mean, what the hell is that?
It's very hard to say. So the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, along with some other Jewish groups, AJAC and Zionist Federation, have been tracking for many years instances of anti-Semitism and trying to measure it in an objective way as much as you can. So they do measure instances of swastika, graffiti and broken windows of Jewish businesses and that sort of thing. And it does vary. And if you look back over a long history, it has spikes and ups and downs associated with geopolitical events sometimes that bring it to the fore. But it has appeared to be increasing recently. So it's another piece of corroborating evidence in addition to what we've got from Victoria Police and ASIO and others who warn us about this. I wish I could explain what that is. I mean, let's be clear, all racism is an evil thing and a terrible thing, but anti-Semitism is a particularly deep and old sickness of humanity. It's been with us for a very long time. It hasn't gone away. You only have to travel to Eastern Europe to visit the former Jewish quarters of cities like Vienna and Prague, where there are virtually no Jews anymore, or to visit the Holocaust Museum in Berlin and hear the stories of people who fled Spain in the 15th century from anti-Semitism to settle in Europe and then encountered Nazism a few hundred years later. It's been with us for a long time, sadly.
Mm.
I'm interested in how your inquiry will be tackling to what extent our security systems and the agency's work is suited to tackling far-right extremism, because, you know, they've been geared for some years towards Islamist extremism. Mm. And in some of the submissions, the agencies have pointed out that some of the way these groups organise a bit looser, even though right-wing extremists have become more organised and more motivated and become more of a security threat in recent years, they tend to organise differently. Mm. And it's been pointed out quite a few times that there isn't any far-right group that's been listed as a prescribed terrorist group in Australia. So how are you going to look at that issue? And do you think that our laws are fit for purpose to deal with this growing threat?
Yeah, I'm anxious not to preempt any of the kind of policy recommendations that the committee might make. It's not my role to do that on my own. It's the whole committee's task.
You'll be looking at that very thing.
But yeah, I mean, I have to say I've been heartened by the way in which the seriousness of which the security agencies take it. In the briefings that I've had with them, in their submissions, they demonstrate that they're devoting significant resources to it. The question of designation of a terrorist entity is a really interesting one. I mean, I think we have to kind of very vigorously follow the protocols and the process of that. It's not to be a political determination. It's a determination based on evidence and dispassionately considered. But of course, if there is a flaw in that process, if there's a defect that has prevented that from happening, then the committee would want to hear about it and will consider it.
What about stepping out slightly more broadly now, just about the role of parliamentary committees and yours? The gag we had at the beginning was the Powerful Intelligence Committee, which is the appellation that always follows.
There's a little known law that requires journalists to include that in their copy. It is compulsory.
I know, it is compulsory, right? Like, the powerful, right?
Lowercase p or capital?
Exactly. But how powerful is it?
I think it's the most powerful committee in the Parliament in the sense that the information has access to and the role that it has, both in oversighting the agencies and providing scrutiny for the very significant powers that they've been given. And I think that's really appropriate in a parliamentary democracy, that there is a non-executive form of oversight of these agencies. It's also powerful in the respect that no security legislation passes the Parliament until it's been considered by this committee, and generally, unless it's been very favourably considered by the committee, there's often recommendations, but unless it has the support of the committee, it tends not to advance.
Yeah.
How does it compare internationally? Well, there's an interesting question that's been considered by a couple of reviews, including the Richardson Review into our intelligence community. There are other parliamentary intelligence and security committees that have stronger oversight. In the United States, for example, they can stray into operational matters. We are expressly prohibited from getting into that. There are very good arguments on both sides of that. There is risk involved in allowing parliamentary committees to have operational oversight. And if we were ever to contemplate that, we'd have to do it very carefully. But I always come back to the principle that in a democracy, it can never only just be the executive that oversights these powers. Parliament has an independent and important role to play in that process.
You were forming those arguments very diplomatically for obvious reasons, but you've said obviously you would need to weigh the various factors before reading in the Intelligence Committee to an operational matter or to building on your powers more generally, given, I think most listeners would sort of have obvious kind of thoughts about why you need to tread carefully there. But it is a problem, is it not, in the Australian political systems, a system that our accountability mechanisms, our oversight mechanisms comparatively are not as forensic as other parliaments in other democracies? What do you think about that?
We also have a more extensive system of independent accountability of our agencies than some other similar democracies. So before this, I was just having a meeting with the committee and the new Inspector General of Intelligence Oversight, Dr. Chris Jessop, who's just been appointed. He's got a significant team with him and he has independent oversight responsibilities. He's not the only one. We have a
Does he need more resources?
He's slated to get some more. One of the bills before the committee is a proposal from the government to give him more resources and more scope for oversight over additional agencies within the national security community.
Because the workload has increased.
No question. As the resources and the powers for our agencies has increased, so has the task of oversighting them. And I think the government is responding to that appropriately by giving him more resources. He's not the only one. There's the Independent National Security Legislation Monitor as well, the INSELM. And of course, on the executive side, we have the Office of National Intelligence, which used to be called the Office of National Assessments, which has been reformed about 2 years ago to be given an expanded role of not just collating the advice of the agencies to provide to the Prime Minister for his regular security brief, but actually overseeing and coordinating those agencies. So we've got a couple of different mechanisms of oversight, and I think that's good. I think we can never rely on just one or even two. I think the three different forms of oversight we have are really important.
And what do you say to the view that's sometimes around that your committee, it's a bit of a closed shop, it's the major parties, it's not minor parties, and most of the time when legislation comes before it, the committee will recommend on a bipartisan basis some changes, which, extra safeguards. But usually the gist of it is pass it with some amendments. Is there a view that your committee, I'm not saying you personally, that this committee, this structure is sort of lends itself to ticking off on these proposals with some minor changes?
Yeah, I guess there's two threads out of that. One is I think the bipartisan culture of the committee is really important. I don't think it's in our national interest for us to have partisan debates between the major parties about national security in the chamber. I think that would be messy and would open us up to real threats, I think, and in particularly in the geopolitical environment we're operating in, I think that would be dangerous. So I think that's a really important cultural element of the committee that I will do my best to uphold. Of course, we do bring different philosophical perspectives and we won't always agree on everything, but by and large, I think we should try and maintain consensus. On the question of should there be minor party or independent members, I am a supporter of the role that minor parties and independents play in our political system. I think they are a healthy part of our political system. I think if we didn't have them, we'd be poor for it. If there's any committee that they are less appropriate for, though, I think it's this one. There is a real burden that comes with being a party of government and having knowing the responsibility that that entails. And frankly, the way that some minor party and independent members conduct themselves demonstrates that they don't feel that burden, that they can engage in political stunts. Of course, you know, political stunts are not only taking place on the crossbench, but I would argue perhaps more often, perhaps more often, and sometimes trivially in a way that I think, you know, any government would have to really think very carefully before putting one of those people on the committee.
I'll pick up Daniel's question and frame it in a slightly different way, because you are a person who genuinely and passionately believes in freedom. That is why you're here.
Yep.
So it's funny in a way that a person who's as attentive to freedoms as you ends up in this process. Mm. So the question I've got is, to what extent, because you've got a comparative lack of oversight powers, if we reference Australia with other democracies, to what extent it renders your committee vulnerable to capture by agencies? It's sort of like, it must be kind of fascinating, really, to be read into some degree about the intelligence assessments, the landscape, dealing with agencies. Now, I'm not suggesting that you would gormlessly go along and, you know, disengage your critical brain, but I'm just saying there's a risk that because of the way agencies operate, right? Like it's they're not really geared. They don't have cultures of openness and accountability. Mm. They don't have, you know, Socratic dialogues, at least not in public. Yeah. So what do you just shake yourself hard in terms of that capture element, right?
Yeah. Look, it's a really good question, Catherine, and I've reflected about it a lot. I mean, firstly, on the freedoms element, I'm not going to take a radical, you know, 180-degree turn and stop talking about freedom as I have been doing for, you know, 4 or 5 years in this place. It's still really important to me, and I bring that focus to the committee. And actually, I think it's appropriate that someone who has that philosophy is on the committee or even chairs the committee, because I think we have a really important role in testing skeptically and questioning whether the proposals brought to us are both necessary and proportionate and have the appropriate protections and oversights that it needs. We wouldn't want anyone on the committee who regards our job to be a rubber stamp and just tick off on any old proposal that comes before us. On the question of capture by agencies, that of course is a risk in this committee, maybe more so than any other committee, but it is a risk in other committees as well. I've chaired other committees before in the financial services and the economic space that have had a real history of getting cozy with the regulators that they're supposed to oversight. And, you know, some of the regulators in this place in the economics sphere have bigger government relations teams than most private companies do, and they spend a lot of time walking these corridors, and they like to, you know, lean on their chairs and committee members to kind of point them in a favourable way. And, you know, they're human beings and they respond to the same kind of incentives that everyone else does. There's probably a greater danger of that in this committee just because of the very nature of the agency's oversight. They are very powerful. They are very respected. They do play a very important role. They're privy to things that we're not privy to, and we should really listen to them very carefully. It is their job to ask for the powers that they think are necessary, and it is our job to make sure that they are necessary and that they're implemented appropriately in our kind of liberal democratic framework, maintaining the strong protections for individual liberties that we all cherish.
I assume you've got some more accountability themed questions too, but I just want to jump in on the freedom stuff. Mm. One of the things that struck me about the ASIO submission to your committee is it mentions about extreme right-wing propaganda, to jump back to that. It says that propaganda has multiple purposes: to intimidate sections of the community, to appeal to new recruits, and to provoke media attention. Mm. So where do you draw the line in terms of freedom and in terms of freedom of speech when it comes to inadvertently giving attention to the types of arguments that attract new recruits.
Which also draws in the platforming, deplatforming arguments with social media and all that stuff as
exactly.
well.
I mean, this is a real dilemma for anybody operating in this space, whether you're a journalist covering it or whether you're a committee considering recommendations or evidence in it. How much do we need to be wary that we are giving them a platform which allows them to recruit? But also how much do we need to be wary of engaging in, censorship's too strong a word, but silencing or an ignoring of these voices in a way that confirms their conspiracy theories and justifies in their minds what they believe. Victoria Police has put in a very interesting submission to the committee in a range of areas, but one of the observations they make is that legislative reforms which restrict speech or ideas or symbols tend to have the effect of confirming for the target audience that all of their fears were justified and that there is a conspiracy against them. And I would say on the issue of, say, Holocaust denial in Europe, that's exactly what's happened. The countries that have anti-Holocaust denial laws where it is a crime, like Germany and France, have some of the worst problems with Holocaust denial and neo-Nazism. Now, I'm not saying it causes it. There's a bit of cause and effect there. They have the laws because they've got the problem, but the laws also haven't eliminated the problem. And I think there is a real danger in driving all of the conversations underground where we can't see them, we can't monitor them. And I think we should all sleep less well at night if that was happening.
It is difficult though, isn't it? Because Anne Webster, a colleague, not a Liberal Party colleague, but a Nationals colleague, had a dreadful time on social media with people with sort of QAnon style, what do you call it, beliefs?
Tendencies.
I don't know, I'm looking for the right word. So that balance you're talking about is really difficult, isn't it? Because she had to seek restitution in the courts because obviously that communication was targeted at her small town and could have caused her significant damage in terms of her character.
But not just her character. I think listening to Anne talk about this in the party room and other places, I think she had genuine fears for her safety as well.
It's the most terrible story.
Yeah, really troubling stuff. And it's just a lot easier than it once was to do that in a really damaging way if you're a fixated or obsessive person, as appears to be one of the issues in that case. I mean, I think we can draw a really bright line between people who are advocating violence or engaging in harassment like that and say that's well outside the bounds of free speech or permissible public debate. That's not the kind of thing we want to encourage, and we should crack down on that very harshly. People who fall short of that, though, I think we have to really reflect on the wisdom of justifying their fears and silencing it, not just because, you know, free speech is an important individual right, which we should all cherish, but because I'm not sure it's effective when it's used.
Are you talking about cancelling Trump on Twitter?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't thinking of that, but and Twitter is a private company and they can have a no Trump platform if they want
to.
That's
their freedom, right. They have the freedom as a private company to remove whoever they want?
Yeah, I don't think it's wise, and I don't think they exercise their judgment well in that instance. If I was running a platform, that's not how I would run mine, but it's not my platform. I didn't create it, and if they want to set up a platform according to their own values, they're allowed to do that. I think they should be transparent about it and say, this is what we're doing. And the problem that Twitter often encounters is perception, if not reality, that they do it in a selective way. I mean, the Ayatollah Khamenei regularly calls for the destruction of Israel and wiping Jews off the map on Twitter, and those tweets are allowed to stand. The Chinese Communist Party engages in appalling denialism of what happens in Xinjiang, appalling justifications of violence against people in Taiwan, open saber-rattling in Hong Kong. I mean, these sorts of things, I think, should fall outside the same bounds, if not much worse, than what Trump ever did, and yet it's been allowed to flourish on Twitter. So I think they need to reflect on how the impact that has on their image as a company.
It's like we could literally do an hour on this, but you haven't got an hour.
No.
And neither do we, sadly. So we need to start to wrap up pretty quickly. I'm going to push you again on accountability because I'm not entirely certain of your view. Do you want more power or don't you?
I'm 3 weeks into the new chairmanship of the committee. It would be very premature for me to be making public interviews advocating for the committee to an expanded role. That's a bit of a cop-out, I accept.
It is a bit of a cop-out, James.
One that I plan to use a little bit in my first month as chair. And if you have me on again in 6 months, I'll give you
a more
expansive view.
Okay, and then one more just quickly because you wear another hat. Well, you wear multiple hats, but one of your other hats is the deputy chair of the COVID Select Committee in the Senate. Very interesting report, interim report this week, giving the government a rap over the knuckles about its use of public interest immunity. Like, basically, you can't have the information because, you know, you're not worthy for the information. The committee as a whole gave the government a rap over the knuckles. Are you concerned that more of this is happening than needs to happen? That's not a very elegant question, but you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. There's a long history of Senate committees disagreeing with executive governments about the scope of their powers and about the legitimacy of the public interest immunity claims that executive governments make to prevent that. And it's not a partisan issue. Oppositions can afford to be more muscular and bolshy on that than governments can. And when in government, some of those same opposition senators have different views. I'm a believer in the institution of the Senate. I'm a believer in its powers of oversight. I think it's really important. In this instance, there are about half a dozen public interest immunity claims which are made by the government, which the committee disagreed with, and I certainly didn't object to the committee reporting to the Senate on its objection. All I've noted is that in the same process, the government has answered about 2,000 questions on notice, appeared before, you know, dozens of hearings. So I think it's unfair to characterise the government's response as a whole as being anti-accountability. It supported the establishment of this inquiry. It's put me on as deputy chair and Senator Perrin-Davey as a member, and we've supported the oversight role, very important oversight role it has to play, because governments are spending more money than they ever have, implementing more restrictive measures on our freedoms and our movements than they ever have, and the consequences of getting those things wrong are profound for all Australians, so it should come with extra oversight.
And I think Katie Gallagher framed this, as you just did, really, as an obligation on this generation of senators to stand up for the powers of the Senate.
Yep. And when Katie's finance minister one day and I'm a shadow minister, I will hold her to that and I'll see if she measures up to that.
I think that's very wise. And a fun note to
end
on.
When do you think that'll be?
Hopefully not for a very long time.
Let's wrap it. Thank you very much for your time, James. We really do appreciate it. There's lots of fascinating issues here, and may well get James back in 6 months and see if he wants more powers. And Daniel will certainly be following the extremism inquiry closely. Just for our readers, we think this is very important and we want to make this discussion as accessible to people as possible. Thank you to James. Thank you to Daniel. Thank you to you guys for listening. Thank you to my executive producer, Miles Martignoni, and also to Hannah Izzard. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.